Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stephen Shea on behalf of Appellant Tanya Rogers. Your Honors, about 4 years ago, in Butler versus Barnhart, this Court examined Social Security Ruling 96-8P in the context of physical impairments. And the case we have this morning presents Social Security Ruling 96-8P again, only this time in the context of mental impairments. The appellant's position is that when we break down the decisions of both the administrative law judge and the district court really to their simplest terms, both the administrative law judge and the district court judge made very similar errors. Initially, with the administrative law judge, he did he performed, as he was required to do, the special technique required for evaluation of mental impairments, and in that, he found moderate difficulties in concentration, persistence, or pace, which is fine. I don't have any dispute with that, and that was supported by the evidence. Both of the state agency physicians made similar findings, although one said marked, one said moderate or marked. However, when we move on to the residual functional capacity assessment, there are no limitations related to concentration, persistence, or pace to be found. Instead, we have limited general public contact. Now, the court below said, well, limited general public contact covers it. I don't see how limited general public contact, which assesses social function, has anything to do with limitations on concentration, persistence, and pace. Now, what makes this perhaps a little bit more egregious is that the administrative law judge determined that the opinions of the state agency physicians were entitled to significant weight. And among the opinions that these state agency physicians gave, other than the concentration, persistence, and pace, was sort of I won't call it a laundry list because there's only four or five of them, but there were a number of moderate limitations that were set forth on the mental residual functional capacity assessment form. These are given significant weight. No limitations related to any of those restrictions appear in the residual functional capacity assessment. I want to make a particular note of footnote 6 of the district court's opinion, because in that footnote, I believe what occurred is that the district court confused the psychiatric review technique and where it stood in the evaluation process with the requirements of 96-8P, essentially finding in rating the four areas of function under the PRTF that was sufficient. And we know that Social Security Ruling 96-8P specifically calls for a more detailed assessment of work-related function. And we know that Ruling 8516 reiterates that and says we must give all the work-related mental limitations that come about as a result of the impairments. So that finding in and of itself, if I'm correct in reading it that way, that we're stopping at the PRTF and saying that's okay, is completely contradicted by Ruling 96-8P as well as 8516.
This is an error, if you're arguing an error of the district courts, not of the ALJs.
Yes, in terms of what was said in that particular footnote, but recall that the ALJ stopped at moderate deficiencies of concentration, persistence, and pace, which is also a PRTF finding. I mean, went on to say, I guess the ALJ's is a little different in that he went on to find limited general public contact as his more detailed assessment, if you will. But in terms of the concentration, persistence, and pace, the error is exactly the same. Let me clarify that. Obviously, the administrative law judge did not say, I'm stopping at the psychiatric review technique and I'm not going any further. The district court seemed to say that doing that, completing the PRTF, was all that was required. And
Well, let's just leave the district court out of it.
Okay.
The commissioner doesn't even defend that aspect of the
court's decision. So in any event, the primary error, as I see it, is that the state agency physicians who evaluated the evidence and completed forms indicating what the limitations were and whose opinions were given significant weight were not considered when we finally got to the residual functional capacity assessment. And because of that, when you get to step five with the vocational expert, all of the limitations related to the claimant's impairments were not then presented to the vocational expert at step five. And that's essentially where we are.
Where would this, if it had been done, where in the course of the opinion would it be?
The residual functional capacity assessment?
Yeah, where should this have been?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that once you get beyond step three of the sequential evaluation and you make a determination of whether or not the claimant's impairments meet or equal an impairment listing, it's at that point that the residual functional capacity assessment comes in. And then that assessment is used to determine whether, at step four, a person with those limitations can perform their past relevant work. And if not, then at step five, whether other work exists in significant numbers in the national economy.
It seems like you're wanting to have the ALJ re-answer the same question at a later stage that's been answered at an earlier stage.
If I understand what you're saying,
the concentration, persistence, and pace of the question had already been answered, and now we're up to jobs in the market.
Well, not really, because there's two separate things going on here.
But you don't answer the same question twice.
Because the psychiatric review technique, which is performed after step two, or I guess it is at step two, if there's a medically determinable mental impairment, you rate four areas of function, according to the regulations. After that, when you do the residual functional capacity, you're required to do a more detailed analysis of the work-related limitations. So, for example, there may be moderate limitations in concentration, persistence, and pace, but as in this case, that results in, if we look at the state agency physician's evaluation, that results in moderate to marked impairments, for example, of completing a normal work day or week without interruption from psychologically based symptoms. So
here's what he did say. He's addressing this moderate difficulty in maintaining concentration, persistence, or pace, and at 53 in the second full paragraph. And then says, but the evidence shows that she is capable of performing simple, routine, unskilled tasks without a significant problem. And it gives an example. So why isn't that the analysis or assessment, I should say, of her residual capacity?
Because that's not what he claimed her residual functional capacity was, and then that did not carry through to the vocational expert. It's also not specific enough.
On the latter point, is that about your question, about your argument about the question put to the vocational expert?
Right, that the residual functional capacity then carries through.
Put that aside for a moment. Your first point, though, was what?
My first point is that if you look at the mental residual functional capacity assessment that's completed by the state agency physicians, and I believe that the judge cited Exhibit 9F and Exhibit 11F, which are at, I believe, 251 to 261 and 230 to 240. I'm sorry, 244 to 247 is Exhibit 9F. And this is the mental residual functional capacity assessment. And what does it say? Moderate limitations in the ability to carry out detailed instructions, to maintain attention and concentration for extended periods, and moderate to marked limitations to complete a normal work day or week without interruption from psychologically based symptoms.
And he has that in the record.
Right.
And
says I give that significant weight. He says I give Exhibit 9F and Exhibit 11F significant weight.
And that notwithstanding those deficiencies, she is capable of performing simple, routine, unskilled tasks without a significant problem. I mean, isn't that the assessment right there of a residual capacity?
If it is, it's incomplete because it needs to have a more detailed assessment, which is exactly what appears.
It goes on to say, in September of 2003, Dr. Lannan found that she had problems with concentration and attention span. That's what you're focusing on.
Right.
But she was able to do simple math and make change. Her memory and judgment were adequate.
Right. But, well, Dr. Lanham's a little bit of a different animal. Dr. Lanham also said substantially impaired social function, adaptive function, concentration, and these things were never even mentioned in the decision.
But she was working at this time, right?
At some point, yes.
At the time of Dr. Lanham's assessment, she was working,
Yes, she had returned to work.
Indeed, until shortly before the opinion of the ALJ.
Right. And I'm not sure, to be completely candid, I'm not sure, having been there at the time, whether she actually stopped work in December of 03 or December of 04. The earnings record shows 03. She said 04, but I'm not saying that as it helps me any, just that that's a...
Work, it was not because of incapacity. It was because of the drug test.
Well, okay, granted, but please understand that there are people who qualify for disability who get up and go to work every single day, and the reason they don't receive it is because of their work activity, not because of their medical, not because of improvement of their medical conditions.
I'm not sure what he
okay. Okay. All right. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that I have a condition that meets an impairment listing at step three of the sequential evaluation process. Okay. If I choose to continue working and I work at a substantial gainful activity level, I will not be eligible for benefits, not because I do not have a medical condition anymore that doesn't meet the listing, it's because I'm precluded at step one of the evaluation process because of my work activity.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it does make one wonder how realistic is the assessment of your medical condition that says you can't work when you're working.
Right. I agree, and I agree 100%. And perhaps if the judge had said, you know, this person was working, so I disregard all these opinions, that's one thing. But consider this, Your Honor: the state agency physician's opinions were made based upon the opinion of Dr. Lanham, presumably, and whatever other evidence was in the file. So to reject Dr. Lanham or ignore it, the substantially impaired part, never mention it, but then give significant weight to the state agency physician, puts you really in the same, you're in the same position either way. If there's weakness in the evidence, the weakness is in both of those pieces of evidence, not just the one that was never considered.
Well, that's an argument for reinforcing the force of this. He diminished the significance of Lanham's evidence because it dates back to a period when she was working.
Except that he never said that. That's the problem.
Okay, but that's the case. And so, too, does the state agency consultant opinion.
Right. The same exact thing, except one you give significant weight to, the other you ignore.
May it please the court. Mr. Shea said there was some disagreement possibly as to when the appellant stopped working. I think the record is very clear that she was continuing to work and to earn substantial gainful activity until December 2004, which was shortly before, 2 months before the administrative hearing. So prior to that time, she had substantial gainful activity and was not disabled. And that is certainly true of the time when Dr. Lanham gave his report. That is, she was not disabled as defined by the statute. The reports by the state agency doctors are consistent with the reality. That is, Dr. Kotz said, for example, that the appellant can work a regular work week so long as she stays away from drugs and alcohol. And she was substantially gainfully employed up until December. Now, one other thing I'd like to just briefly address, and that is I think there's the implication in the brief, appellant's brief, that somehow the ALJ should have included in the question to the vocational expert the fact that she had moderate limitations in certain areas. That is not a correct view of the law. What the ALJ did was decide that because of her moderate limitations, she could only do unskilled work. So the question was there work, unskilled work, that this person could do? And you see there's a, I think there's a serious problem if you try to go beyond that in trying to figure out what can the vocational expert actually testify about. Because it's not the vocational expert that decides the extent of the limitation, the psychological limitations. That's for the ALJ to decide. If there are no further questions, that is all we have, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Case is submitted.
Stand, please.